Hey folks, Scott Weingart here from the MCrit podcast. So I had a new podcast in the pipe for you folks on the crashing patient with meningitis, but I then had a crashing computer. Can I just say Windows sucks? It's okay, I didn't lose any of the files, I just lost my entire operating system. But that podcast will not go up this week. In its stead, what I have for you is a lecture I gave at the Neurocritical Care Conference, which is held each year in New York, and all the brilliant neurointensivists from across the world come to speak, and then you get a EM critical care joker like me there too, talking about hypothermia and airway. Well, this is the hypothermia lecture, and what I realized is we haven't had any hypothermia stuff on the MCrit podcast, which is just crazy because it's one of the primary things I'm doing right now is working with folks in New York City to get a citywide hypothermia system going. I'm working with brilliant guys like Stefan Mayer and all the folks from the Fire Department of New York, FDNY as we refer to it, and we've been doing some pretty good stuff. Well, this lecture is what I have gleaned from doing about 100 hypothermias personally. And as I mentioned in the lecture, that doesn't sound like a big number until you start your hypothermia program and realize doing 100 is a whole bunch of hypothermias if you've done them yourself. So without too much further ado, here comes the lecture. What I will say is that I will very often make references to slides. Just so you know, MCrit slide style is four or five words on a black screen, so you're not missing much, not reading the slides in real time. What I will tell you is there's one slide that actually requires you to see it. It's a tracing of a simultaneous acquisition of temperature from both a patient's rectum and their esophagus. Two probes, simultaneous, and when I refer to it, you'll understand what I mean, but essentially the rectal probe doesn't budge, the esophageal probe very quickly goes from a temp of around 36 to 34 in about 20 minutes. That's really, I think, the only slide you need to see. But all of the slides are on the MCrit site, blog.mcrit.org. The show notes for this particular podcast has a link to the slide set if you want to follow along or take a look later. All right, with that, we'll get to the lecture. I hope you enjoy. It is 45 minutes from this point on. If that's too long to listen to in one big gulp, then just come back to it later. But, you know, normally we do about 20, 25 minutes. This one's 45. I'm sorry. I did not get a chance to break this into two separate lectures like I did the ventilator podcast, but hopefully this will still work for you, even though it's against my beliefs that anything longer than 20, 25 minutes, no one could really pay attention to. All right. Send me emails as always. Put comments in the show notes. And I look forward to talking to you again soon when that horrible Windows XP system is back and functioning like it should be. All right, let's start. I start all these hypothermia lectures with this phrase, don't give up. Because post-arrest used to be a pretty nihilistic disease. Most of these folks did not have a good neurologic outcome, even if you managed to resuscitate them. And it was pretty depressing. Everything's different now. Hypothermia has changed the game. Folks that come in with no mental status could actually walk out of the hospital on their own two legs and go back to their family. It's amazing. So this lecture is about is 100 post-arrest hypothermias. That I've personally taken part in. Now, for most things, that wouldn't be a big number. For post-arrest hypothermia, it's actually pretty high. I work at Elmhurst Hospital Center and Mount Sinai, and Elmhurst is the busiest hypothermia center in New York City, last time I checked the statistics. We do an insane number of post-arrest hypothermias, on the order of three a week. So we've seen a ton. I'm the director of the Division of Emergency Critical Care at Mount Sinai and Elmhurst, and I have no conflicts of interest.
I'm not taking money from any of the hypothermia machine companies that you'll see out there. So if I talk about a machine, it's because my own personal belief, not because I'm getting any funding for it. In fact, I take no money from anyone, drug companies or otherwise. All right. It's always a little nerve-wracking to give these lectures at these neurointensive care conferences because the neuro guys have such big brains. You know, big, big brains. Me, I'm a simple-minded guy. What I deal with is nuts and bolts. That's what I like to make my clinical areas of expertise. I like translating all that literature to the bedside and actually trying to find a way to make it work. Trying to integrate all that evidence into real life care, not the theoretical ivory tower care. Now, if I am an expert on hypothermia, it's because over the course of the past 3 years, we've made every single mistake it is possible for a doctor to make when it comes to hypothermia. We've screwed up everything. And that leads to getting a pretty good understanding of what the right things to do are. All right, the handout for this lecture is at this website. And I'm gonna show it again at the end, so if you don't wanna write it down now, you can write it down later. But all of the articles I'm gonna talk about are actually there in PDF form, and the slide set is there as well. So you can take notes, but it'll all be there for you, so you don't have to worry. All right, how many folks have hypothermia programs again in this group? All right, a whole bunch. So the folks that do know already that the classic division for hypothermia was divided into three phases. There's the induction phase, where you take a patient from whatever temp they start at to between 32 and 34 degrees Celsius. There's the maintenance phase, where you leave them at that goal temp. For us, it's 33 degrees for 24 hours. And then there's the rewarming, where the patient should be actively rewarmed very slowly. Usually, the same amount of time it took to get them down is how long it should take them to get back up. And then the phase we don't talk about, but we probably should, is a phase of forced normothermia. Just because you're done with your hypothermia protocol, if these patients spike a temp, you actually lose some of your neuroprotection. So there really should be a fourth phase where you're being really aggressive about watching these patients' temp curves, and if they start spiking, putting them back on the hypothermia machine to keep them at a normothermic level. All right, so let's talk about the hypothermia. Treatment. I'm going to do it in the form of a top 10 list. I'm a big Dave Letterman fan. Hopefully that'll work well. You start off with the first 20 minutes. You get these patients in the emergency department post-arrest, and there's a whole bunch of hullabaloo. You're going to start with the ABCs, just like any critically ill patient. And then you get a finger stick. And if you don't do this early on, sometimes it gets forgotten. And it's really embarrassing to be 40 minutes into a post-arrest management and then find out the guy had a finger stick at 20, and that was the reason for his original arrest. You're going to get a brief neuro exam. And I mean really brief at this point, because you don't want to stop hypothermia from being induced to do something extensive. What we do is we get the pupil exam, we get a GCS exam, and we do a really good brainstem exam. And at that point, that's enough for us to decide whether or not they're going to get hypothermia. This is a really good time to get in your lines and tubes, because generally the paramedics have given these guys hundreds of times the physiologic dose of epinephrine or various other catecholamines, so their blood pressure is usually pretty good at this moment. And what happens over the course of the next 20 to 30 minutes is that wears off and these patients start to crash. And that's not a fun time to be getting in your sterile neckline or your arterial line. So now's the time in these first few minutes. Oftentimes I see these post-arrest patients, because their vitals look good, this time gets squandered, and people, they start doing other things. They might be taking care of the patient with difficulty breathing across the way. Don't waste this time. This time is super valuable. All right. The next question you ask is, what did them in the first place? Something caused this arrest. Just because they got resuscitated doesn't mean that's been fixed, and you go through that differential. The biggest one being ST elevation MI. So you get your 12 lead early, you screen them for STEMI, and if you're in the right center, you could actually now activate cath lab while you're doing the hypothermia, or you could give them lytics. You also consider PE, subarachnoid. There's a whole list. We're not going to deal with post-arrest management today. We're primarily dealing with hypothermia. So again, don't squander the time. These patients get much worse off half hour into their course. All right, the next thing we do is we get a rectal temp. And we're not talking about the hypothermia machines, temperature probes. We just stick a regular thermometer in at this point to get a baseline temperature. And we do this early on because that tells you where you are in terms of your hypothermia induction. So we just have one of the nurses or techs get us a rectal temp. I'm going to tell you in the course of this talk why I think a rectal temp is a horrible way to monitor patients during hypothermia. But at this point, it's fine to make this your baseline level. And then we screen them for hypothermia. And that brings up the first point, which is who do we cool? Who do we cool after a rest? Well, the first point, number 10 on the list, is cool everyone going to an ICU, in my opinion. And if I wanted to expand that just slightly, I'd say any non-trauma patient who's post-arrest, who doesn't follow commands, meaning their GCS is less than 6 on their motor score, who's being admitted to an ICU. Now, that brings up a lot of controversy, because there's folks out there who still say, we shouldn't be cooling PEA, we shouldn't be cooling a systole, we shouldn't be cooling respiratory arrest, because the data's not there for it. And in some ways, they're right. Let me try to make an argument from my perspective. If those people who felt we shouldn't be cooling PEA and a systole said, we're not going to admit those patients to an ICU, we feel their prognosis is bad, that's why we're not doing hypothermia, and they put those patients on a floor bed and switched them over to a palliative path, that would be a logical argument. I would buy that. I wouldn't agree with it, but I would support the logic of that decision. But that's not what most people are saying. Most people are saying, send them to the ICU anyway, but don't do hypothermia. And that makes no sense to me. What's come out of the hypothermia studies is, at least in adults, hypothermia does not generate patients who would have otherwise died, and they turn out to live, but they live with no neurologic function. We haven't generated, an excuse the vernacular, vegetables from hypothermia. And if that's true, if you believe that, then there is no reason not to induce on any patient you're sending to the ICU. There's just no logical reason not to. And there's a little literature support. Odo looked at this and looked for the factors that lead to good prognosis, and rhythm fell out of the multivariate analysis. It had no part in it. It was basically time from arrest to ROSC that mattered. And oftentimes the asystole PEA patients had a longer time to ROSC, and that might be why we think that they don't work as well. The FDNY data, the Fire Department of New York data, which hasn't been released, but I've gotten some glimpses of, also support doing it in PEA in asystole patients. And there's abstracts out there as well. But I would tell you that as long as you believe the evidence that we're not generating vegetables, there is no reason not to induce anyone post-arrest that you're willing to devote ICU resources to. Because that's what it comes down to is, for me at least, it doesn't cost me anything extra to do hypothermia if I'm sending them to the ICU anyway. And I want the patient to have the best chance of good neurologic outcome. So we cool everyone we're sending to an ICU who's not following commands. If you're going to induce them, number 9 is to induce as quickly as possible. For me, the only way to get speed of induction is using ice saline. And I think there's no better way to induce a post-arrest patient than normal saline, or whatever crystalloid you want to keep in your fridge. There are machines out there that will induce. They don't induce as quickly as the numbers I'm generating with ice saline. What we get is, if you do things properly, you get a degree Celsius for every liter of saline, and it takes about 10 minutes to get a liter of saline in under pressure bagging. So that's a degree every 10 minutes. You can't beat that with any of these machines. These machines that are specifically made for induction don't have any maintenance component. So basically, you're paying a lot of money for something that can't maintain the patient afterwards. Now, there's always this argument, you're going to drown your patients. These post-arrest patients are going to have pulmonary edema. There's been 2 studies looking at this, and again, all these references are on the site. It's not true. They don't have an increased rate of pulmonary edema. In fact, when you look at the literature, what you find is that even after your induction with ice saline, when you look at their heart and decide whether they need more volume, they need more volume apart from the ice saline induction. You're actually giving them room temperature fluids or more cold fluids specifically for the purpose of volume loading, not even for your temperature induction. So these patients do not drown. Quite the opposite. You're going to have a hemodynamically rocky course unless you adequately volume load them. And almost all my hypothermia is post-arrest. I wind up giving more volume on top of the induction fluids. This article compares the post-arrest to a sepsis-like state. What it's essentially saying is that just like a septic patient that's vasodilated, that has leaky vasculature, the post-arrest patient has that same syndrome. They're essentially SIRS patients. They need the fluid to fill that tank. So don't worry about drowning these patients. Very different story for, say, a myocardial infarction patient who didn't have an arrest, who you're doing induced hypothermia on for heart protection. Those folks, sure, if you gave them 6 liters of fluid, you might have some issues. They have normal vasculature. In fact, they're usually vasoconstricted. So those folks might have a problem with that fluid. They already have a failing heart, that's why you're doing it. So don't generalize to all the hypothermia modalities, but at least for post-arrest, they need the fluid, and therefore, ice saline is the way to induce. All right, you're gonna place them on temperature monitoring. And that brings up point number 8, which is use an esophageal probe. Use an esophageal probe for the induction stage of hypothermia. When we first started, we used rectal probes. We thought rectal is the gold standard for temperature monitoring, for our ICUs, for our EDs, that's what we were using. That was the best there was rectal temperature monitoring. And we didn't read anything to tell us differently. So we did a bunch of hypothermias using rectal probes, and almost inevitably, our patients dropped down to 29 degrees Celsius, 30 degrees Celsius. We couldn't figure out what the heck was going on. And then we switched to esophageal probes because we actually did figure out what's going on. And I'll explain what was going on in just a sec. And then we avoided these overshoot issues. We no longer sent these patients down to very low temps. Esophageal probe monitoring is the best way to go for the induction. And the reason is a concept called probe lag. Probe lag means that certain areas of the body, like the rectum or the bladder, actually don't equilibrate with the core for many minutes after there's a temperature change. So rectal temperature is incredibly good if the patient is in a static state. But when they're in dynamic, rapid temperature changes, the rectum doesn't keep up with the core. And as a result, what the rectal temp is reading is very different than the patient's actual core is. And so what was happening is, this is one patient we actually did simultaneous monitoring on. The blue line is their esophageal probe, and the red line is their rectal probe, simultaneous measurements. What you'll see is we were giving them isaline, and they got almost an immediate drop in their temperature, and this very nice straight line down until they were at goal temp at about 20 minutes. So it's just like I was telling you before. In about 10 minutes, you get a degree Celsius. This patient pretty much kept to that line with the esophageal probe. And they took about 2.5 liters of saline, if I remember correctly. Look at this top line. That's the simultaneous rectal monitoring. Doesn't budge for 15 minutes. And at the 15-minute mark, it only drops slightly. If you were doing rectal monitoring on these patients, you would keep giving them isaline at that point, and you'd give them a ton more isaline because they haven't budged their temperature. And that's where you're going to run into problems with volume overload, if you're going to have any, is if you're using the wrong probe, these patients will get 10, 11 liters for no reason. When we switched to esophageal, these issues went away. This is from Dr. Polderman's article. This is the time of probe lag for each of the actual sites. And you can see intravascular, like a PA catheter, obviously there's no lag. That's core monitoring. Esophageal is pretty close, 5-minute lag. But the rectal probe, 15 minutes, which is just what you saw on that chart. And the bladder, which many of us in the ICU consider the standard, is even worse, 20 minutes. Don't use bladder probes for induction. They will not work for you. Bladder probes are fantastic for maintenance. Then there's very slight perturbations of temperature. Bladder probes are great for your ICU maintenance, but during your rapid induction, they will not work. You'll overshoot. I think the esophageal really is the only decent probe for induction, unless you have a central line or PA catheter that could do it for you. All right, you gotta treat shivering aggressively. One of the hardest parts about a hypothermia protocol. And that leads to point number 7, paralyze for the induction. Now I'll tell you, I had to be brought around to this viewpoint. When I first started my hypothermia protocol, I was adamantly against paralysis. When I was standing there at the bedside doing aggressive assessment of shivering, I could get any patient down to temp without paralysis. And I would be sitting there with my little pharmacopoeia, and I'd push a little of this and a little of that, and my patients would get down to temp without paralysis. But what I found is when I was there, or one of the critical care specialists I hand trained, those patients were getting down to temp in less than an hour. When I wasn't there, and when one of the nurses had bought into this stuff wasn't there to make sure things went right, it was 3 to 4 hours. And the reason it took so long to induce those patients was shivering. And even though we had a stepwise shivering protocol, it wasn't being done. At this point, I think the best answer is just routinely tell people to paralyze for the induction. Not during your maintenance phase, not for their whole ICU course, just one shot of either sisatricurium, which is Nimbex, or vecuronium for your induction. When the patients get down to temp, they don't need the paralysis anymore. They're shivering. The worst part of it is during the induction, not during the maintenance. At this point, I say just paralyze for the induction. Give the patient some sedative agents and pain control, and then just push the Nimbex or vecuronium. And once we started that, our numbers got much better. I argued with Stefan when we were making the fire department protocol. He said, let them paralyze. I said, there's no need for it. And it turns out, yet again, he was right. So now I'm with him, paralyzed for the induction. This is our shivering protocol. You might have seen it up in the simulator sessions, because I wrote the case. But everyone's is a little bit different, but they generally have these common drugs. It's just a question of where they come in. And so we're using the bedside shivering assessment scale. Neeraj, who you might have met upstairs, invented that. Are you folks using that scale for your shivering assessment? Pretty much nothing else out there, right? Generally, zero, and which is none, or one mild. This is just an occasional shivering of the extremities. You might just see it on an EKG lead as your only indication. You could leave those guys untreated. Two or three moderate or severe, they need treatment. And we start all patients, we give them Tylenol through their G-tube or through their rectum. Does it work? I don't know. I think it works very well on the forced normothermia, patients who are not post-cardiac arrest. I'm not sure how well it works in these guys, but it's a cheap shot. We do it because it doesn't cost us anything. It might help. If they're still shivering greater than one on the scale, we add on fentanyl. The opioids have some of the best literature for anti-shivering. Of course, Demerol being the prototype, we extrapolate that to the others. We don't use Demerol because of its seizure potentiation. And so we add on a fentanyl drip. It's also gonna be making sure the patient has no perception of pain, just in case we're not really assessing their level of consciousness as well as we could, and we don't want them undergoing this hypothermia and being in pain. Still shivering, we add on propofol. We also have the option of dexmedetomidine, a little bit less literature on that than some of the other agents, but there is some. If the patient's hypertensive, we'd go to dexmedetomidine, usually preferentially. If the patient's hypotensive, we try to avoid it. Not that propofol is any great shakes for that as well, but there's not such a large number of choices for those patients. If they're still shivering, that's when we bring in the counter-warming of the extremities. And for anyone who doesn't have experience with this, the idea is when you go out on a cold day, even if you have a nice heavy coat on, if your hands are uncovered, you shiver, you're cold. Your body perceives the environmental temp from your extremities and your head. So, you know, if you go out in gloves and a hat, even without a coat, you feel pretty good, even though your core might be getting pretty cold. Well, we're using that same trick to get these patients to stop shivering. And what we'll do is we'll actually put forced air warming on their extremities. We'll cover up their head, and we'll try to trick the hypothalamus into not shivering anymore. And this is pretty successful. It's a lot easier if you have the catheters, because then the catheter does core cooling and you're doing extremity cooling on the outside. But it works just fine on the blankets. And I'll tell you, our system is blankets. And we just put a bunch of sheets between the cool blankets that are on the patient and the warm air that's on their arms to keep some insulation between the two, and we get good effect. If that doesn't work, we add on magnesium. And magnesium is fantastic for a number of reasons for post-arrest patients. I'll tell you why in just a bit. But that's our next step. If none of that has worked, we'll actually use ketamine. Ketamine just has a couple studies for its use. The question I always get asked is, isn't that gonna increase intracranial pressure? The answer is no, that's been debunked, it doesn't do that. The only way it would increase intracranial pressure is by raising blood pressure if their patient's blood pressure was already sky high. Not generally an issue for these hypothermia patients. So as long as their blood pressure is reasonable, you can do ketamine without worries about the ICP. And in fact, it has some putative neuroprotective effects as well. If that doesn't work, there's one thing I don't have on here that we do, which is we actually drop their temperature further. There is a threshold for shivering. There's a point at which your body stops. That's why all these poor skiers that get lost initially maintain temp and then lose it. As they get too cold, their shivering response disappears. That's what we're trying to take advantage of in these patients. So if we had them at 33 and they're still shivering, what we'll do is we'll drop them down to 32 on our machine. We might give them a little ice saline to get that kick started. And sometimes at 32, the shivering threshold will be passed, and these patients will stop shivering by making them colder. Kind of paradoxical. None of that works, we'll paralyze them. I don't do drips. I think sometimes these patients will need one shot when they get their muscle control back, they're not shivering. There's no reason to continuously drip these patients. So we'll give intermittent boluses of sitagliptin preferentially because it has Hoffman degradation as its breakdown pathway and therefore won't be affected by the hypothermia, by kidney failure or liver failure. Because the last thing you want is someone with vecuronium staying on for days and then the patient gets their neurologic check at the 72-hour mark and they're actually having their exam blunted by the paralysis. If you're just doing intermittent boluses and you get them to the point where they're shivering again before you give another one, then you don't really need train of four monitoring. If you want to keep them continuously, then you have to institute that. All right, number six is you need a machine. I've seen a few articles using ice packs to go really cheap, and that might be okay during induction. It might even be okay during maintenance, but you're not going to have controlled rewarming with that method, and that's why it fails in my mind. So you need a machine at some point in the patient's course so you could have that nice controlled rewarming. Same thing, I saw an article that was using fans and they were spraying cold water on the patient to get that convective cooling. Again, it might work for induction, it might work for maintenance, it's not gonna work for rewarming. You're not gonna have a controlled rewarming. So my opinion is you need a machine. You can use whatever machine you want. We have these dirt cheap Blanketrol machines that were in our hospital already. They're probably from the 1980s. They were just up on the floor. They were using them for patients who spiked the temperature on the general medical floor. That's what we grabbed. That was our hypothermia program. I'm a stubborn guy. I said I wanted to be able to do hypothermia for no cost. We're not at no cost, but we're less than $80. It cost me, I don't know, $2 for my isaline. It cost me less than $70 for my non-gel blankets. That's great. I could tell anyone you don't need money to get a hypothermia program. But what I found is the more money you spend, the easier your life is. If you upgrade to the gel blankets like the Arctic Sun, you get a little tighter temperature control. The nurse's life is a little bit easier. If you get an intravascular catheter, you get even tighter temperature control, still easier. So you get what you pay for. If you want to go dirt cheap like us, then you're going to be able to do a hypothermia program. It's going to take a little work. If you want to spend more money, things become easier the more money you spend. And you make the decision based on your hospital. All right, so 33 degrees for 24 hours. In parentheses, I have 32. That's where I'm keeping most of my patients. There's not great evidence for that. If you read the animal studies, that might be a better temp. I don't recommend it in my protocol. Our protocol is right at the 33 mark, but I'm generally sending my patients down to 32. All right, number five. Post-arrest patients need incredible nursing, but that's not the hypothermia's fault. And what I mean by that is that before a hypothermia program, if these patients were in the ED, stuck in a corner somewhere with one nurse for five patients, including that arrest patient, and then you start a hypothermia program, of course you're going to have to increase your nursing. But that nursing should have been increased before the hypothermia protocol. These post-arrest patients are some of the sickest patients you'll ever encounter in clinical medicine. And it's not the hypothermia that should generate aggressive nursing care and aggressive clinician involvement. The post-arrest patient, regardless of hypothermia, needs that same level of nursing. Hypothermia should not add to that burden. Hypothermia is pretty easy compared to all the other stuff the post-arrest patient causes you to have to deal with. So post-arrest patients need incredibly intensive nursing, but the hypothermia is not what makes that happen. And if I go to a hospital who's not doing hypothermia and I look at their nursing staffing, you just don't want to send post-arrest patients to those hospitals usually because they don't take these post-arrest patients seriously. When they get the hypothermia protocol, it forces them to take these patients seriously, and that's a good thing. All right, number four, don't blame the hypothermia for the hemodynamic instability. Everyone loves to make hypothermia the scapegoat for everything bad that happens on these patients. It's not the hypothermia's fault. The hemodynamic instability almost inevitably is from the post-arrest state. Post-arrest is a state of vasodilation, as I mentioned, a septic-like state. It's also a state of cardiac stunning. For 24 to 48 hours after the arrest, the heart will not function very well. You might have an ejection fraction of 10%. Any cardiologist throws on the echo probe and they go by their experience of cardiogenic shock patients with that same degree of heart function, they say this patient's going to die. Write them off. You know, we'll give them a try, but they're not going to make it. Their heart is not going to happen without a transplant. Very different in hypothermia patients. They are cardiac stunned. which means it's a reversible phenomenon. They might have an ejection fraction 10%. You look at them 72 hours later, they have normal heart function. Don't write these patients off just because of their hemodynamic instability. It's usually worth being as aggressive as possible if there's any chance of neurologic outcome. Now that we have hypothermia, there is a chance of neurologic outcome. So these folks do deserve balloon pumps, and the Taiwanese are actually putting them on bypass with good results, nice reductions in the risk of death. And the patients they have who are living with good neurologic outcome. Because if they get them through those first 2 days, you have a patient with good, normal heart function. So hypothermia is not to blame, and don't give up on these patients just because they look like absolute dreck when you first get them. The bradycardia, biggest bugaboo in my hypothermia protocol. The normal heart rate for a patient at goal temp is somewhere between 35 and 45 beats a minute. That's what you should see. What we have routinely is we'll start off with the patients, we send them up to the ICU, and they're under-sedated, they probably are under-volume loaded, so they have a relative tachycardia of 90, 100, and that's where they start when they get up to the ICU. And then they get their sedation package aligned, they get their volume loading, and now all of a sudden their heart rate is 40. And that just means that they finally got this patient where they needed to be. They finally optimized everything. And that's the point they turn off the hypothermia. They finally got the patient where they needed to be, and that's when they discontinue the hypothermia because they're scared of the bradycardia. Don't be scared of the bradycardia. Bradycardia is what you should see. If you're not seeing bradycardia, you're missing something. Either the patient needs more sedation, more volume, something else is going on. They should be at those 40 beats a minute. Don't let your folks stop the hypothermia because of it. All right, dysrhythmia. Everyone wants to blame the dysrhythmia on the hypothermia. It's not the hypothermia's fault. Hypothermia at the temps we're talking about is a cardiac stabilizing agent. If the patient's having persistent runs of VTAC, VFib, don't discontinue the hypothermia. Check your labs, and if that's not the problem, send them to the cath lab. They have persistent ischemia causing this dysrhythmia. The hypothermia is only helping you, not hurting you on the dysrhythmias. Now sure, if they go down to 28 degrees Celsius, you got some dysrhythmia issues, but that's not the patients we're talking about. 32 to 34, cardiac stabilizing agent, hypothermia is not to blame. Bleeding, everyone's scared about the bleeding effects of hypothermia. They're minimal at the levels we're talking about. When you get below 34.5 degrees, you might have some antiplatelet effects. Generally, these patients need that because you'd be giving them aspirin anyway, whether it be because of their cardiac ischemia, their STEMI, what have you. And it's minimal, the antiplatelet effects. If for some reason you don't even want those minimal effects, you could give them DDAVP, and that should reverse it. There's been a couple articles on that. A big fear is you'll take an undifferentiated cardiac arrest patient and then you find out their cause was subarachnoid hemorrhage. That's not an uncommon one, especially if you're living in Japan where they have a higher propensity of subarachnoids. And my clinicians got very scared the first time this happened. They're like, we made the bleed worse by the hypothermia. Not true. And in fact, Dr. Polderman's lecture is going to be on specifically inducing hypothermia for head bleeds and other patients with high ICP. So it's okay. Here's what I do when I find the subarachnoid. First of all, I reassure everyone that it was a good move to start the hypothermia. I let them drift up to 34, right on the outside levels of that neuroprotective evidence-based area for post-arrest. I'll give them the DDAVP. At that point, 34 degrees with DDAVP, they're getting very, very, very minimal effects on bleeding, if any at all. You're not increasing the volume of the head bleed. So if you have a patient who, you know, has bleeding from a central line, don't stop the hypothermia. It's not the hypothermia's fault. The bleeding effects are minimal. All right, number three, hardest part of the lecture. Labs become tougher with hypothermia. How many folks are ICU docs? Yeah, so you've dealt with these issues if you have a hypothermia program. Labs are really torturous, and the labs we're generally dealing with are blood gases, magnesium, potassium, calcium, and glucose. This is how it should look, because you really want to push the mag. Magnesium has anti-dysrhythmic effects, there's some putative neuroprotective effects, and you're getting the anti-shivering effects. So for all those reasons, you want to keep your mag high normal. What you don't want to keep high normal is your potassium, because as you probably saw during the simulation, there's an influx into the cells of potassium during the cooling, if you correct them to high normal and then rewarm them, they're going to get hyperkalemic. So we don't correct until they get to 3.5, and we're very gentle with our potassium. The cardiac guys sometimes get upset. They want to have the antidysrhythmic effects of a high K. What we tell them is use the MAG. You know, you can't get everything you want. You can't have them at a K of 4.9, but you could push the MAG, and that'll probably give you some benefit. Calcium is incredibly important from the patient's hemodynamic standpoint and from their cardiac function standpoint. You want to really push the calcium to high normal, and it's probably got to be ionized calcium in these patients. And that's going to give you inotropy. It's going to reverse some of the cardiac stunning effects. Glucose, you know, it used to be a big issue in the ICUs with this tight glucose control. Thankfully, that's now abated to some extent. We say 180 to 200 is the number we're looking for. And there's a nice study there from the New England Journal. But there's also specifically a resuscitation study in post-arrest patients. And what you'll find is for any of these brain injury patients, if you keep them at that tight plasma glucose, that 80 to 120, the injured areas of the brain are actually hypoglycemic. And that's a big problem for injured brain. So don't go crazy on your glucose. 180 to 200 is what we're looking at. And that brings us to blood gases. Whew. Gosh, it used to be just the cardiovascular, you know, the CT anesthesiologist that had to deal with these issues. You know, it wasn't a general problem for most ICU guys. Now with induced hypothermia, we all have to deal with the alpha stat versus pH stat issue. So we'll talk about it just briefly. The concept of alpha stat is you don't tell the lab what the patient's real temp is. So the lab thinks they're at normal body temperature, 37 degrees Celsius, and they analyze the blood gas that way. And then you come along, you look at your blood gas, and you actually optimize their pH and CO2 based on these uncorrected values. So you correct to 40 with your ventilator, the patient's real CO2 is somewhere around 32. So you're leaving these patients in a state of respiratory alkalosis. The alpha stat argument is that the body's enzymatic functions work better in a hypothermic patient with a slight degree of alkalosis. And it's debatable whether it's true or not. Most of the CT guys I know have moved to an alpha stat idea. pH stat is the opposite. You tell the lab what the patient's body temperature is, so you get real values. So the 40 CO2 you optimize is really 40. So what this leads to is the pH stat, you have higher ICP because your CO2 is higher, but you also have higher cerebral blood flow. Alpha stat, conversely, you're decreasing the ICP by doing a slight degree of hyperventilation, and as a result, you have decreased cerebral blood flow because you have a lower pHCO2. Which one's better? I don't know. So we just split the difference. That's what we do in our shop. I think that's what most of us have moved to. And here's the easiest way to never have to think about this debate and never have to think about calculations, never have to correct a blood gas. This is the easiest I can make, and it's pretty close, I think, to what's optimal. There's some rounding here to make these numbers nice and round to remember them more easily, but it's pretty close. What you do is you don't tell the lab anything. So you just send the blood gas just like normal. You don't have to write anything on your slip. And then you optimize the CO2 at 45, which when you look at it, you say, oh, that's hypercapnia, but it's not. If you knew what the real CO2 is, it would be around 35. So not quite the alpha stat of 32, not quite the pH stat of 40, it's somewhere in the middle, 35, 36. And so you're gonna optimize generally a pH of 7.35, which when corrected is a slight degree of alkalosis. And here's the key, the minimum PaO2 you'll accept is 80. Because if you were to correct that, it would be 60. And that'll give you a saturation around 90. I don't want to see a patient lower than that. So you just remember that number of 80 is the absolute lowest you'll accept on a gas PaO2. Preferentially, you want a little higher, 100 to 120 will give you around 80 to 100. But you don't have to remember the corrections. Just remember that. Remember at least 80, better 100. Remember 7.35, and remember 45 on your CO2, and your values would be perfect. If you want to make it a little tougher for yourself, you could tell the lab the patient's temperature. But the key to that is you have to look at the lab slip or the computer to make sure they actually did it. Because at least in our shop, we'll tell them the patient's temperature, they won't correct it, and then you're really going to be screwed. Because you think you're dealing with corrected blood gases and you're not. So that's why I say the easier way is just to forget about the correction and then you don't have to trust your lab. But if you trust your lab, you'll shoot for a PaCO2 of 35, a pH of 7.45, and a PaO2 of at least 60, but preferably 80 to 100. Because these are all the corrected values. Hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. All right, number two is to rewarm slowly and rewarm actively. And you know, the numbers vary depending on which neurointensivist you speak to or intensivist, between 0.1 and 0.33. I think that's generally the range you're gonna see these days. I'm a 0.25 guy. I like that nice quarter of a degree. I think most of the Columbia guys are 0.2. I think Dr. Polderman is 0.1. But somewhere in that range is what's important, that you're doing it slowly. That generally takes as long to get them up as it took to keep them down. So if you had 24 hours of maintenance, it should take around 24 hours to get them back up to normal temp. And that actively is the most important thing. What we see is these folks go on their hypothermia machines, they're there for 24 hours, and then some of these ICUs just take them off the blankets and let them come up to temp themselves. That's gonna be way too quick. You wanna actively keep them at a slow rewarming, which means if you're using the older machines, each hour you just put in 0.25 higher than it was the hour before. If you have some of the newer machines, you could actually put the temp curve you want them to rewarm at and not have to touch it. This is what I mean about the more money you pay, the less work it is. But either way, you need a machine to keep them rewarming slowly. All right, last but not least, hypothermia really screws up prognosis. We have no idea, generally, early on, which patients are gonna do well, which ones aren't. Used to be 72 hours, you'd wake them up, make sure they had nothing on board. If they were doing nothing, you say, sorry, let's go down a palliative route. It's not like that anymore. 72 hours, the patients could be looking horrible, and some of them will still leave. And the problem is we don't know which ones. But I look at that as actually a good thing, because it means patients we never would have thought could walk out of the hospital actually can now with hypothermia. So all the annoyances with prognosis are actually beneficial to our patients. So to review, I'll say you already had your simulation session. This was the review for this group, so that's good. If you haven't seen this article, this is by Dr. Polderman. It's in Critical Care. The PDF itself is on the website. This is the most fantastic article for the actual nuts and bolts of post-arrest hypothermia. Absolutely incredible article. All the slides and references of what we just spoke about are on this site, nychypothermia.org. All the articles there, PDF form, some videos, so check it out. This is my blog and podcast if you're interested in ED critical care issues, which certainly feed into regular ICUs, neuro ICUs as well. A lot of stuff on airway ventilator management. If you're interested, check it out. You can check us out on iTunes as well. Just search for MCRIT. This is my email. If you have any questions, I'm happy to hear from you. And with that, I'll thank you so much for your attention. Thank you so much for coming out today.